Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:43 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is November 18th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. Well, the news coverage has been almost entirely dominated by the events that are happening on the periphery of Europe, and government bond spreads have been expanding. Now, this has been a rather different condition than what we've had over the last few weeks, because some of that selling has extended towards Austria, Finland, and the Netherlands. Now, there's no real rationale for that. They have, if one considers that Germany's balance sheet is strong, their balance sheets are equally strong. So that represents a rather irrational edge that has appeared in what has otherwise been a mob moving from one weak creditor to or one weak liability to another. And they've now moved on to what would really be considered strong strong nations, and that is irrational. Now, other things that have been happening this week, well, October was a spectacular month on the upside. Most markets bottomed somewhere around the 7th of October, rallied spectacularly into the first week of November. They've been pulling back. Now, most of those markets were overbought in the very short term. A number had rallied right back up to test the underside of their 200-day moving averages. The DAX in Germany is such an example. They have all encountered resistance, and some have pulled back more than others. In the government bond markets, U.S. Treasuries are back in the region of 143. That's a tad below their peak. Gilts are back to 130. They've eased a bit in here. Euro bonds are at 136.72 at the close today. That's down for three consecutive days. The value of German government debt relative particularly towards Austrian debt really can't there isn't a great deal of difference between the two. If people are now starting to think about selling Austrian debt, they may also start thinking about selling German debt. They Germany has some huge unfunded liabilities that people don't seem to pay attention to at all. Elsewhere in the markets this week, West Texas Intermediate had a huge surge. It's rallied over the last 6 weeks from $75 to $100. It pulled back in here in the last couple of days. It's currently at $97. This is really quite overextended in the short term. A pullback and consolidation of gains looks more likely than not at this stage. When you look at natural gas has fallen precipitously over the last 3 or 4 weeks. It's currently back to $3.32. Now, that isn't even remotely economic in terms of unconventional gas production. So there is going to be shuttering that is going to happen. Natural gas prices at these levels are unlikely to remain down here particularly long. But we haven't had anything in the way of a sustained upward dynamic in here either. The industrial metal complex, much like some of the weaker stock markets, have also been weaker over the last couple of days. Copper is one that had rallied really quite impressively in October, had went up, tested its 200-day moving average, and pulled back. Platinum, palladium, and silver are behaving more like industrial metals and copper today rather than gold. They all rallied rather well last month. They've all pulled back. They've all encountered at least some resistance. Silver was down over $2 yesterday. It's stronger today by 78 cents. It needs to do substantially more than that to get back above its 200-day moving average and begin to convince investors that dominance has returned to the side of the of demand. Now, gold did not fall below its 200-day moving average. It continues to have one of the more consistent uptrends, particularly in the commodity complex. It rallied impressively from its 200-day moving average a couple of months ago. At this stage, it was down there at $1,550. It encountered at least short-term resistance in the region of $1,800, and it has pulled back from that level. It's a little bit overbought in the very short term, but The chart action continues to look like a consolidation, pause and consolidation support building phase in advance of setting new high ground. This remains a consistent uptrend. It really would require a sustained move below the 200-day moving average to question that view. Now, there's at least $200 between current levels and where the MA was back in October. The MA has probably risen a bit since then, but that's quite a lot of volatility that can still happen, and there's still be really quite a consistent advance. Something that the volatile action that we've seen over the last few months has probably taught us is that betting on something that has just broken out hasn't been particularly rewarding unless it's been in a very secure high-growth sector. So things are best bought when they've had a pullback. And we are currently in the midst of at least a partial unwind of a short-term overbought condition. When there's evidence that these markets are beginning to find support once more, well then that will be probably a favorable entry point. When we do a big, when we click through a whole range of shares, there's some things that really stand out. The first is that the industrial sector really got hit very hard back in July. That's the sector that is most leveraged to global GDP growth, and you have a recessionary environment across the vast majority of Europe. Until recently, Asia has been on a monetary tightening binge, and a large number of countries have, until very recently, been raising interest rates. Some are now beginning to lower interest rates. That's particularly good news. The USA remains in a low-growth environment. Now, the economic indicators that come out from time to time have been a bit more positive than I think many would have been expecting. The USA remains unlikely to move into a recession. But stagflation is very much a reality in Europe. There are some sectors that where there is clear inflation, there are other sectors where there is clear deflation, and you have this persistent debt problem that isn't going to be solved anytime soon. The big question is it going to be robbed of its capacity to continue to shock markets? Erwin Grandinger's response to David's question that we're going to post in comment of the day shortly is really worth reading, because it says in very simple terms that the German government are going to wait until the very last second before they agree to quantitative easing and money printing by the ECB. There is an inevitability to all of this. They aren't going to allow the euro to disappear. That would suggest that they're going to squeeze as much out of the peripheral countries in terms of austerity and concessions as they can while they still can. This is their one great lever. Once quantitative easing has been engaged upon, then it's going to be more difficult to get politicians out there on the periphery to agree to additional bouts of austerity. So they're trying to get as much as they can right now. That means that we're going to continue to have this uncertain environment until quantitative easing is eventually announced, and there is an inevitability to that. I think we're probably much closer to that type of situation when you start to see that the lending rate at which really quite solid countries like Austria, Finland, and the Netherlands starts to expand relative to bunds, that really is a risible type of condition. When we look at where the leadership is, it's quite clearly in consumer-related shares. Now, these are shares that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. And we have, at present, there are literally hundreds of millions of people moving and in the process of moving, getting ready to move from the country to the city. And that's a secular progression. It's probably the greatest exodus in history. And it's not specific to any one particular country, but Asia is one of the least urban areas in the world as a percentage of its populations. And that's going to change in the next 30 to 40 years. The countries that get it right, in other words, those that have improving governance and have planned to provide for their massive populations are going to prosper in this type of environment. Countries that have those large populations and that do not have the forward planning have failed, and we've seen a large number of examples of that in North Africa in just the last year. China and India in particular, but also Indonesia and Malaysia, are large population countries that have been planning for quite some time to accommodate their large populations. They've been encouraging GDP growth, they've been liberalizing in terms of trade, they have low debt to GDP ratios on a government and a personal level. They are export oriented, they have been investing heavily in their education, and they've been importing the most up-to-date technology to leapfrog in terms of their technological prowess and the quality of their infrastructure. Asia is the center, the driving engine of global GDP growth, where we have GDP growth in excess of population growth, and you have improving governance, so it means that the additional capital that's being created is being spread out among the population. The growing consumer base in China and India and most of Asia, not to mention in the Middle East and right across Latin America, they aspire to the standard of living that we take for granted, and they are working towards a better standard of living for themselves and particularly for their children. They are, I suppose, last decade was all about infrastructure development in China. China has crossed a threshold because it now can get more GDP growth from investing in its human capital than from infrastructure. Now that's a milestone because China is now a middle-income country in terms of its per capita GDP. The people that were once happy to work for next to nothing for very long hours in terrible conditions in low margin factories have moved on. That means that the country has to move on too, or there's going to be civil unrest. So China has embarked on a massive program of moving the whole economy up the value chain. Now, there was an important news item this week that they are shuttering 90% of their lead smelting. Now, lead smelting is a particularly dirty, environmentally damaging business. It's no longer in China's interest to maintain that industry. But what they are investing in is they're investing in education, they're investing in high technology, they're encouraging really quite large value-added industries to site and be created within the country. So you're going to see Chinese cars on the roads, you're going to see Chinese planes in the air, and at some point you're going to see Chinese electronics making inroads into Western markets. There's an inevitability to that type of progression that really can't be taken for granted. And we are really only at the beginning of China's evolution in terms of its consumer base. The fact that it now makes more in terms of GDP growth by investing in its people is a landmark in another sense, because it means that civil rights will become a much more relevant consideration for many Chinese people. They're going to want the quality of living that people take for granted in the West. They're going to want the consumer goods. A lot of them have already been bought, particularly in the tier one cities. But the further you go from those tier one cities, the further back you go in terms of development. And China's consumer base is really quite underdeveloped relative to most other countries. And that fact alone would suggest that there is plenty of room for development, but it's also a government priority because they want to develop the consumer economy as another prop for its wider economy, because at the moment it is really quite exposed to the slowdown in its export markets, as well as the slowdown in the housing market domestically, which the government has engineered. So it is a priority to increase the size of the consumer economy. And to do that, they need to invest additionally in social security and in healthcare provision, so that the massive domestic savings rate can be realigned into the consumer economy. That's a secular advance. It's not going to happen overnight, and this week was particularly weak for the Chinese economy. It had two downward dynamics this week, and it really does need to find support above the October lows, and that's a condition that's similar to most stock markets. The stock market has been laboring in China for the last 2 years, but the growth of the consumer economy has been the leading sector in the economy. It doesn't look like it's at a bear market at all in consumer staples. And that is very similar. That's a very similar condition in India, where the fast moving index has been among the leaders, despite the fact that the wider market has been in the malaise for the last year. And one can look at consumer sectors right across Asia. They are the clear leading sector, and that commonality feeds right through into Europe and into the USA, where some of the leading companies, the companies that still remain above their 200-day moving averages, that were first to break upwards back in September, that have been some of the best performers in October and have still had the smallest pullbacks, they're almost universally leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. We're currently in the greatest urbanization in history. There's going to be approximately 1.7 billion people move from the country to the city in the next 20 to 30 years. When we look at some ratios, and I produced a number of ratios on Monday and again yesterday, I found a very good website. It's multiple.com. And you'll find the link to that in Thursday's comment of the day. It's got extraordinarily long-term charts of P/E ratios, dividend yields, and treasury yields. U.S. Treasury yields equal the yield on the S&P at present. If you look back to the 1880s, equities yielded considerably more than bonds for the majority of that time up until about 1950. Now, the reason for that is because equities were considered a much more risky asset relative to bonds, and investors had to be compensated for taking on that risk. Now, that all changed in the 1950s as the yield in equities began to fall. It became a much more desirable asset class. The companies were representative of the growth of the middle class in the USA, and some of those really high-profile shares were some of the first to go and tap the global markets. They were representative of some of the best performing shares all the way through the 1960s and 1970s. By comparison, US government bond yields peaked at 16% in 1982. They've been compressing ever since. But when we look at where the world is today, you have countries in Asia that are well capitalized, have low debt, low leverage, and P/E ratios that are attractive, reasonable dividend yields, and are cited within the highest growth economies in the world. You have companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer rather than their domestic economies. So when we compare those companies to treasury yields, they're already yielding more than treasuries. But it isn't because they are a riskier asset class. It's because they are fantastically well-run companies. These are companies that have outgrown their domestic economies. David refers to them as autonomies, and that's an accurate description, because they have the status at this stage of small countries. They can go where the growth is. They can adapt effectively to various markets around the world, and some of them at this stage can be considered almost recession-proof. Now, that's almost That's an exaggeration because there is nothing is recession-proof, particularly if it is fo if the recession is focused on that particular sector. But they have weathered the recent volatility really quite incredibly. If I was to make a choice between high-quality equities and low-quality bonds, then I know where I'd be going. It would be almost exclusively into high quality equities. And if I were to own bonds, it would be the bonds of high quality companies rather than low quality governments. US government bonds have been compressing for over 30, government bond yields have been compressing for over 30 years. That isn't a position that is sustainable for the long term. It's already been long term. At the top of every bull market, supply explodes. We've seen that with government bonds. We've seen it in just about all bond markets. An increasing number of companies and countries are issuing 100-year bonds. They're attempting to lock in the lowest cost of capital that has been available to them ever. If you look at the really long-term charts, US Treasury yields haven't been this low since 1940. That's 70 years ago. Now, that was just before the Second World War, and the country had come through decades of a depression type environment. Now, the US has had a difficult 10 years, the secular valuation contraction that has been that Wall Street has represented isn't over. The ranging environment on the S&P, where it's been ranging below 1500 since 2000, hasn't ended either. But there are companies, particularly within the USA, where there is a surfeit of multinationals, but also in Europe and a number in Japan and elsewhere, that no longer represent their individual countries. They represent a massive growth in the global population and in the ability of people to afford the better things in life. And these autonomies represent secular bull markets. These are companies that are likely to benefit from the potential for the global economy to continue to expand, and particularly the spending power of its various growing middle classes. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.